Welcome to this 11KBW podcast on investigations in the courts, how to challenge them and the judge's perspective by Tom Ogg.
Good afternoon. One of the key purposes of an investigation is to gather evidence. And if there's one thing that judges prefer, it's to see the evidence rather than not. So in terms of the judge's perspective, the starting point is often, I'd rather see the evidence. The other judicial preference in terms of evidence gathering is that if evidence is to be gathered, they'd really rather that someone else gathered the evidence rather than it all appearing in front of them in court in some poor, haphazard way. So again, judges' general preferences are for an investigation to be done because it simplifies matters and makes any subsequent court hearing more straightforward. So I thought I'd start with a couple of cases where an investigation has stopped and a court is evaluating in a judicial review context a public body's decision that an investigation should cease. The first case is the Corner House Research case. This is where the Serious Fraud Office was investigating BAE Systems in relation to alleged bribery in Saudi Arabia. And then what happened was the Saudis said to the UK, if you carry on with this investigation, we're going to withdraw from security cooperation with the UK. And frankly, that's going to put the lives of your citizens in the UK at risk. And so the SFO, after thinking about it carefully, decided to stop the investigation because that security cooperation was more important than working out what BAE had been up to or not. This went all the way up to the House of Lords and to former members of these chambers, Philip Sales, now Lord Sales on the Supreme Court, and Karen Stein, now Mrs. Justice Stein, persuaded their lordships that it was fine. And in particular, that only in highly exceptional cases will the court disturb the decision of an independent prosecutor and investigator in this public context. Different case, slightly closer to one of my areas, financial regulation. Mr. Grout brought a judicial review of the FCA's decision to stop an investigation. The difference here is that the investigation was into Mr. Grout's conduct. Odd, you might think, that Mr. Grout was saying, excuse me, I'd like you to continue to investigate my alleged misconduct. But the reason was that he had been charged by the DOJ, Department of Justice in the US, and a UK investigation would probably interfere with the criminal investigation in the US. So it suited him to bring a public law challenge to the FCA's decision to stop an investigation. Unsurprisingly, he lost. It was a rational decision for the FCA to not investigate him, partly because of the US proceedings, partly because the US proceedings were public, and so it's not going to work in financial services anyway. So there, the judges were content with an investigation being stopped. As I say on the slide, there is obviously, I say obviously as an employment lawyer, very substantial case law on what a fair investigation looks like in the context of a claim for unfair dismissal. And one of the key cases is the Sainsbury's case, which says that there's a range of reasonable responses in relation to the steps that an employer may take. As regards an investigation, some employers may do one thing, others may do other things, but outside that range, there are things an employer must do or must not do. The next general point I wanted to flag is that investigations, notwithstanding all that commentary, they don't have a special status for the purposes of discrimination law or whistleblowing law or contract law. If you can show that an investigation is in breach of contract or was a detriment imposed because you blew the whistle or is discriminatory, then you can bring a claim in relation to those matters. And I've pleaded many a claim in relation to that, and I'm hoping to avoid being the subject of any claim in relation to any investigation I do. But there is sometimes, as I've intimated, some scepticism towards the subjection of an investigation attempting to challenge it. Now, what I'm going to talk to you about a lot is privilege, and privileged investigations in particular. Now, when I started out in practice and studying law, nearly 10 years ago now, the topic of privilege was, the law was in a bit of a mess, but at least it wasn't litigated much. It was, it was what it was. It's now been litigated a lot in the last 5 years or so, and the law remains fairly confusing and complicated, but also it's been changing quite a lot as well. So there's a bit of a story to tell about that and privilege investigations more generally, because it suits particularly corporates when they are being pursued by regulators or central criminal authorities to undertake an investigation, but then essentially keep the findings for themselves by saying that the findings are subject to privilege. I can't reveal to you, regulator or governmental authority, what the findings of this investigation were because they're privileged. And that's very common. And sometimes corporates come a cropper in relation to that. So, for example, I represented an individual who had been dismissed in relation to libel misconduct. He brought a claim for unfair dismissal, and he sought disclosure of certain documents that he knew existed, which were privileged vis-a-vis US law, but we infer from the fact that they settled, not UK law. And so it can be a very useful tool in the hands of a litigant. And other times that privilege comes up, I represented an individual who was the head of health and safety for a PLC, and he wrote a report essentially saying that the really terrible things that had happened in terms of a person's death and someone being raped was the result of failings of the company. The company then alleged that his report was privileged, not just against the world, but as against the individual who wrote the report as well. So we had to litigate that. And I'll tell you that the answer is it wasn't confidential in respect of him because he wrote it, and therefore they couldn't rely on privilege as against the individual. So just running through the key concepts here. Legal professional privilege, or LPP, has two limbs. There's one overall privilege, but it's two applications of it, legal advice privilege and litigation privilege. Separately, a different species of privilege is without prejudice privilege for the purposes of settling disputes. This only applies to lawyers, and the Prudential case settled that vis-a-vis tax accountants, and the courts decided that even though it didn't make much sense, that was the way it's always been, and it's for Parliament to take a different view, should they wish to do so. So what is legal advice privilege? Well, you can see on my little lists there, generally you need a communication, and it's only communications between the client and the lawyer. That's the key difference between advice and litigation privilege. Made in confidence, that limb is key, as you saw in my health and safety case. And then for the purpose of giving or receiving legal advice. And I put dominant in there in square brackets because that's the most recent change to the jurisprudence, that the purpose has to be not just a purpose of the communication, but the dominant purpose of the communication. And I'll take you through the case law that establishes that. And then in relation to litigation privilege, again, a communication, but this time between the client and the lawyer, or the client and a third party, or the lawyer and a third party. But it has to be when litigation is in progress or in reasonable contemplation, with the sole or dominant purpose, same concept, of obtaining legal advice or information for adversarial litigation. I've already referred to WP privilege. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to talk through legal advice privilege, and then after that I'm going to talk about litigation privilege. So just looking at advice privilege, first of all, one key area for litigation is who's the client? Because the critical feature of advice privilege is that it's a communication between the client and a lawyer. And in the big corporate world we deal in now, it's been challenging to identify who is the client within a corporate for the purposes of legal advice privilege. And that's because legal advice privilege doesn't apply between a lawyer and a third party, i.e. someone who's not the client. Now, there's been a lot of litigation about this. I'm not going to take you through it all in detail, but essentially all of these cases apply three rivers, no five, and I'm not going to tell you all about that litigation again, because I'm sure you've heard it before. But the bottom line is, as the law stands, where a client is a corporation, an employee is only the client for the purposes of legal advice privilege if they're authorised to seek and receive legal advice. In other words, the interviews of employees, i.e. those people on the ground who saw what happened in relation to whatever the investigation is about, if they give evidence to external lawyers during an internal investigation, that won't be covered by legal advice privilege. That's because those employees don't have the authority to give and receive instructions. And so the position in law is that the results of those investigations are not covered by legal advice privilege. And that was confirmed recently in the Court of Appeal case called ENRC. Two short points following from that. Number one, the answer to this problem most of the time is litigation privilege, where legal advice privilege doesn't provide a means of cloaking those investigation reports in privilege. Litigation privilege usually is the answer. The second point is that word in brackets there, reluctantly. So ENRC is a mining company. A whistleblower raised issues about fraudulent practices in Kazakhstan and Africa. There was an internal investigation. 184 employees were interviewed, and the Serious Fraud Office wanted to get hold of those interview transcripts. And the Court of Appeal applied the law as I've just described it, but said that they see much force in the argument that Three Rivers No Five is wrong. If it had been open to us to depart from Three Rivers No Five, we would have been in favour of doing so. So essentially, it's a matter for the Supreme Court, and someone needs to take it to the Supreme Court, and I expect the law will change. So slightly awkward position in advising clients. On the one hand, this is the law. On the other hand, if you can get litigation privilege to apply, use that. Or the other route is to go to the Supreme Court. Not clear which will be the most expensive option there. How else have... sometimes investigations occur where it's just not credible to say that litigation is in prospect, because usually the circumstance in which you can say litigation is in prospect is where you've got a regulator or another party already bearing down on you and talking about beginning legal proceedings, and sometimes that's just not the case, particularly in an employee misconduct context. And the attempts to get around this case law include take notes but intersperse it with legal advice so that it creates a bit of a nightmare of redaction and argument. Don't take notes at all. So I've seen this happen where you essentially parachute in a lawyer, they do a sort of preliminary interview with the key people, don't take any notes, and then there's nothing to disclose. And then they say orally, well, this is what I think is going on. And it provides a sort of mini insight into what is going on without having an argument about documents. Or present findings as legal advice. My advice to you in relation to this is blah. That's because I think this has happened. All of which are subject to challenge, all of which are tricky potentially, but those are the routes apart from litigation privilege. So I mentioned that someone needs to take it to the Supreme Court, and it might be Jet 2. So this is a decision, my first 2020 reference, a decision in January of this year by the Court of Appeal. And the shift that I referred to earlier is that the Court of Appeal said, if you're going to apply legal advice privilege, you have to show that the dominant purpose of the communication was seeking legal advice. Now, where's the shift in that? In other words, it can't be just a purpose. It has to be the dominant purpose of the communication. You can't just sort of copy a lawyer in just in case they might give some advice. The purpose of the communication has to be, I'm seeking legal advice, and then you can claim legal advice privilege. So just some background on JET 2. So this is a judicial review of the Civil Aviation Authority, and the Civil Aviation Authority released a press release criticising JET 2 for not participating in a voluntary ADR scheme for customers getting their money back when there's problems with flights. There was then some correspondence between JET 2 and the CAA, which the CAA then published without JET 2's permission. JET 2 JR'd the Civil Aviation Authority's decision to make the press release, publish the communication. Disclosure in this case was pretty juicy. One of the internal communications at the CAA included the line, JET 2 is the most litigious airline. Let's refer to their billionaire chairman. That might not go amiss in this process. Attack dogs, please, Lord S. Lord S being their communications director. Clearly, then, there's no blood loss between JET 2 and the Civil Aviation Authority. And perhaps the billionaire in question will go to the Supreme Court, as I mentioned. The main point of the decision, though, as I say, is that the dominant purpose test applies to legal advice privilege. You have to show it's the dominant purpose of the communication, as opposed to, say, receiving commercial views on what ought to be done or other practical views as to what ought to be done. Hinkinbottom LJ said, in respect of this, the jurisprudence is far from straightforward and the authorities do not speak with a single clear voice. But nonetheless, that's a decision. A couple of helpful practical points. What if you send an email to a lawyer and a non-lawyer? Well, it depends on what the dominant purpose of the communication was. If it was to seek advice, then it's privileged. If you're primarily seeking a commercial view as to what to do, it's not privileged. However, any reply from a lawyer, that will be legal advice. That will be privileged. Similarly, you go to a meeting where you've got a lawyer and a non-lawyer. Are the meeting minutes of that meeting privileged? Well, depends on the dominant purpose of the meeting. If it's to seek legal advice, prima facie, the minutes will be privileged. If it's to seek commercial views or work out what to do in the normal way, and the lawyer's just there because they're a senior executive or whatever it may be, then on its face, the minutes won't be privileged. But if there's a bit of it where the lawyer chimes in and says, legally, blah, 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 then that can be redacted in the normal way. And finally, emails need to be considered separately to their attachments. Okay, so that's advice privilege. Now on to litigation privilege, the other species of privilege. The ENRC case I was referring to earlier, the general feeling is that that lowered the threshold a little bit in being able to show that something is covered by litigation privilege. You have to show that there was a realistic possibility of litigation or criminal proceedings for litigation privilege to apply. And in that case, that applied even though ENRC was producing the documents in question to show to the SFO. That was the idea. And indeed, the purpose of the investigation was to head off an SFO criminal investigation. Now, one of the things about litigation privilege is that you have to be able to evidence whether there was that realistic possibility of criminal proceedings. And usually that involves a witness statement, usually from a general counsel or some senior person like that. And the conundrum is that you can't have the general counsel saying, basically, yeah, it was a murder, absolute murder, because that's going to put you in trouble in your criminal prosecution for murder subsequently. But you also have to say enough to say that at this point in time, I really did think that litigation was a real possibility. And what's critical here is contemporaneous evidence. West Ham, this case here, this is another illustration of the fact that just because lawyers involved doesn't mean it's going to be privileged. The documents here were the directors essentially discussing the amount to settle for. How much should we settle for? That wasn't privileged because they were internal emails within the client. They were not for the purpose of obtaining advice. They were for the purpose of deciding commercially how much to pay by way of settlement. Two slides now on how you deal with privilege practically. What happens? What's the process of arguing about privilege if you've got a dispute in a legal case? Well, first of all, how does the privilege issue arise? Well, usually two ways. Either you produce a disclosure list and you say you're not having this or that because it's privileged, and then there's an argument about it. Or the other side has the document anyway, and it adduces it, and you say you can't rely on that in evidence before the court, it's privileged. The first point is that LPP is a human right. It's a fundamental principle of the justice system. If you can make it out, it's going to take a lot to outweigh it, Derby magistrates. The burden is on the person claiming privilege. That's West London Pipeline. Generally speaking, an affidavit or a witness statement will be conclusive. But if there's some ambiguity, the court will order another affidavit from the lawyer concerned who says it's privileged for these reasons. Cross-examination of the lawyer may be required. It used to be the case that actually looking at the allegedly privileged documents by the court was a last resort. So you could object to the court looking at the thing that you're so worried about being privileged. That's changed slightly in the West Ham case to inspection being a matter of general discretion, according to that case, rather than a last resort. Court should be cautious about doing so and alive to the lack of context, but it's not a big no-no. Okay, injunctions. So this is the final topic from me on the court's approach to investigations. And hopefully not stepping on David Glenn's toes too much. Good, he's shaking his head. Excellent. I'll read this to you. So the courts will only restrain publication of a report by a public body if there are pressing or exceptional grounds for interfering with the expression of opinion or conveyance of information, particularly if the public body is under a duty to express its opinion or convey information. So here, this was a decision by the Advertising Standards Authority that this organisation was in breach of its code. And the decision was, well, publication here is what ought to occur, notwithstanding the fact that an appeal was outstanding, that the facts were disputed and so forth. It takes a lot to persuade a court to suppress by injunction the publication by a public body of an investigation report. Next case, Hussein and Sandwell, in which James Gowdy, our head of chambers, was involved, as was Ronnie Dennis. And I hope they won't feel I've besmirched them by saying that the case was about the sale of some public toilets below market value and the cancellation by this local councillor, Mr. Hussein, or reduction in value of some parking tickets to his family. And this was allegedly contrary to the councillor's code of conduct. Fortunately, the test isn't high crimes and misdemeanors, as in the case of Mr. Trump. It's just the local authority code of conduct. And here, this is another case emphasising that, notwithstanding the fact that in this case the investigation findings were only preliminary and subject to a formal decision, that it takes a lot to suppress an investigation report, the publication thereof, by injunction. As I say there's an important public interest in openness and transparency, both of which go hand in glove with accountability. These Nolan principles are expressly enshrined in the local the LA Act 2011. The present claim involves an attempt to suppress independently collected and collated evidence and analysis about possible wrongdoing. No plausible justification has been advanced which overrides the importance of enabling a spotlight to be directed on the conduct of the authority in seeking to address this sort of potentially serious misconduct. And then finally, there's a line of case law arising particularly in the context of the publication of Ofsted reports in the education sector. And this is an application of what I read out to you earlier in relation to the Advertising Standards Authority. There's a higher test that applies when you're dealing with public bodies. It's described in the City College Birmingham case there as follows: the test of the judge's thermometer in terms of response to an injunction will be set and calibrated several degrees higher so far as looking at the arguability of the case. There's been some recent case law questioning whether that higher threshold is justified. First of all, Intervida Investments, where it was questioned, and then in my case, Just Childcare, where it was ignored by the judge, and then in Barkingham Dagenham College, where the High Court said, found that in that case they had no qualms in that high test being applied. And then finally, injunctions in an employment context. As it says there, courts appear to be more willing to grant interim injunctions in the employment contractual context. And then I would add on the words, where there is a contractual disciplinary policy, and that's the case in the NHS. And so almost all of the cases concerning stopping or controlling investigations and matters around that arise, as in these three cases, in relation to the NHS. And one wonders why the disciplinary policy continues to be contractual, because it causes them so many headaches from a litigation perspective. I'm not going to take you through those three cases, save to say that the first one has been reversed by the Court of Appeal since this slide was written. But it does show you that you can get an injunction even if it's wrongly given. And that's it from me. I'm now going to hand over to...
This talk was given at the 11KBW Inquests, Inquiries and Investigations Seminar on 11th of February 2020 at Crown Plaza, The City, in London. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.